Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome to the Brandel Chambly podcast with Jaime Diaz. Man, we are in a disruptive time right now, and I hope everyone's doing well, and that actually golf, at least the golf community, is somewhat unified through this in terms of just communicating more. And so we're going to try to be part of that. And in that vein, Brandel, welcome. Great to be with you. I wonder how golf has sort of been incorporated in your life during this very disrupted time.
Well, the course that my wife and I are members of has been shut down, but it's pretty close to our house. So we take walks every day and we walk over there and we play imaginary golf. Although I'm not sure that Bailey likes my commentary because it seems like more of her golf shots are hitting trees and being shanked out of bounds than mine. Mine seem to end up pretty close to the hole. So I think she's going to take over the commentating duties going forward, and we'll see how it goes. But we're taking long walks every day, and inevitably we end up on the golf course where both of us, as we're walking around, we, you know, like what is prettier than a golf course? I know we're biased because we're in this sport, but honestly, I after having walked around this golf course and just without clubs, you know, nobody's out there, just us. It's like, I don't know what sport is more beautiful than the game of golf. Certainly no venue is, at least in our view. So we've enjoyed it, but our hearts go out to the people in the golf community, because I'm sure it's devastating to the golf community. I mean, it's the golfers who are, I think, the least impacted. I mean, they're, if anything, just inconvenience, but when you start to think about the extension of the golf community, people involved in food and beverage and the hotels, and many caddies, and on and on and on it goes, because golf is a destination game as much as anything. And you just can't help but feel for the many people that are impacted by this disease.
Yeah, thanks. It's interesting that you'd be drawn to still go to the golf course without clubs. You feel a lure, like almost an ancestral childhood lure.
Well, there's no prettier place to take a walk, is there? You know, yeah, I mean, we can't do it normally because there's golfers everywhere. But, you know, we try to get in at least 10,000 steps a day, although Bailey gets in quite a bit more than that. But, you know, it's a great place to go get in those 10,000 steps. It's peaceful. You know, it is just so beautiful and peaceful. They're still maintaining the golf course. So, you know, it certainly looks like you could tee it up no problem. We've resisted the urge to take a club or two over there and chip around because, you know, obviously that wouldn't be right. But anyway, it was Bailey's idea. She was like, all right, here we go. We're going to play a round of golf here. No clubs, just imaginary golf. And it's actually been quite fun. Very funny, actually. So we've had a lot of good times with that.
Do you factor in all kinds of shots or just good ones?
I don't know. We have a good time. You know, it's like she's like, hey, how come you hit it 8 feet and I hit it in the bunker? Like, well, I don't know. Maybe I just handle the pressure better than you. You know, maybe I just have a better creative mind than you. I don't know. I'm really seeing the shots today. Maybe you're just not seeing them today, you know? Maybe you need more experience with situations like this. So I think she's going to take over the commentating duties. I'm sure that there'll be a 180-degree turn in the outcome of our golf. She's actually come close to beating me a couple times in the 10 years that we've been playing golf. She may well do it for the first time in an imaginary round of golf. It could be this afternoon.
Well, I played with Bailey four holes once. I see how much she loves the game, how competitive she is. And with
she does.
And so many interchanges, especially with people who can kind of hang with you verbally, it's a battle of wits. And so there's a battle going on no matter what.
Oh, she can do that. Cool. Yeah. She can just stare at me and cut me to shreds.
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been luckier in the sense that I can play golf here in North Carolina, and I got two great places to play at Pine Needles and Mid Pines.
Oh, nice. Clubs, which,
yeah, they're really idyllic,
nice.
You know, ideal kind of walking courses. You've been to North Carolina and how, yeah. How you know, it's like a postcard sometimes. But, you know, I play alone a lot. I just carry my bag. And, you know, first, I just feel the gratitude to be able to do it. And, yeah. You know, all these things that have been taken away from us, hopefully temporarily, all the sacrifices people are made. You know, when you have something that you can play unencumbered or do something that you love unencumbered, you do feel even more gratitude for the opportunity. And I don't know, it's been some of the most enjoyable golf I've ever played in sort of a, you know, ironic way, I guess. And my mind is clear. I think about my game. Obviously, I'm thinking about the world and everything else, but there's a certain feeling of, you know, real, I don't know, closeness to what it means to you and how it's been important in my life. And, you know, a little more clarity of thought about how to fix my game a little bit more. You always have those little epiphanies when you're playing alone. Sometimes they don't hold up in front of other people, but I do feel like I've come actually to a better sort of understanding about why I have these persistent swing flaws and how perhaps to address them a little better. And of course, it's all mental and it's all about mostly reducing tension and understanding how not to beat yourself with, you know, a lot of expectations and a lot of judgment and a lot of things that are just interfere. But I mean, that's all sort of, you know, very granular golf stuff. But in the big picture, it's just really fun to just be able to walk. And as you said, be drawn to a golf course and enjoy what it all is. I mean,
it always
strikes me how I think misplaced the debate about golf courses and the environment can be sometimes. Not to say that golf courses haven't infringed on the environment in bad ways, but in general, they're an enhancement to the physical environment. And we're just very lucky to have these beautiful places. And even without a golf club, just you out there walking, I think, says a lot about what golf brings to our life.
Yeah, I feel lucky. You know, almost every day that I play the game, even when I play it poorly, I still feel lucky for the gifts that the game of golf gives me every single day. My wife comments on that all the time about her life, how she was a basketball player, a volleyball player, a good athlete, but she had some knee troubles in high school. And there was never a doubt for her. She was going to switch to golf when she was a sophomore. She knew she was going to get a scholarship because she was a good athlete. But she, you know, beyond that, she didn't have any big plans about the game of golf, but she says, you know, now looking back on it, she says, you know, I cannot believe how gifted I've been in my life just through the game of golf. And it is the game that every single day that you play it gives something back to you, you know, without being too melodramatic. It is, as we're walking the golf course, you know, it touches you, you know, it absolutely touches you. It makes you feel alive and lucky to be alive. And if there's anything that this virus has, I think, certainly reminded Bailey and I, is the fragility of life. And, you know, as you get out there, you think, you know, I mean, appreciate every day. And this is part of it. Get out with people you love, spend a little time. And, you know, if anything, you know, this sequestered life that we're all living right now, it is about spending time with people that you love and conversations, longer conversations, because nobody has anything to do or anywhere to go. So it is about reconnecting not only with one another, but also with sort of a spiritual way, why you fell in love with the game of golf.
That's well said. Thanks, Brandel. Hey, you know, we had talked in the past, and I know this is one of your favorite topics, and I thought we'd revisit it because I know you have some deep thoughts about it. And that is simply the idea of talent and where it comes from. And is it innate talent? Is it developed talent? Is it innate skill? Is it developed skill? And, you know, I think you take a view that is somewhat contrary to the conventional wisdom that some people are born with a number of gifts and that basically life is about, you know, maybe finding the potential in those gifts. But without the gifts, you have a pretty low ceiling. And you're saying the ceiling can be raised with a lot of great work. And I'll let you just expand on that if you don't mind.
Yeah, I actually was talking with Rory about this recently when I was down in Jupiter filming episodes for Golf Pass, which I think aired tonight or posted tonight. And I think I asked him if it bothered him when people said that he had a lot of God-given ability or natural ability or was just innately blessed with the talent to play the game. And he said, yeah, he said it did a little bit, that it's a bit of a disservice to all the hard work that he put in to develop the game. And I have long thought that. And I posted a video from the 1984 Masters. Is one of the things I've been doing is going back and watching the Sunday rounds of all the Masters and trying to finish all of them up to date, starting back with 68. So 84 was particularly poignant for me because I was at the University of Texas and I was a senior, and Ben Crenshaw eventually won the event. So I knew Ben, and saw Ben around town, and you know, so it was certainly a big event for me. But watching that Sunday, he made a putt on the 14th hole, which, at least in my view, is superior to the one he made at the 10th, which no doubt that it was a beautiful putt, and he read the putt beautifully and hit it beautifully, but a large amount of luck went into making the putt at 10. I think even if Ben was sitting here, he'd agree. Conversely, the putt he made at 14 was about 12 feet in an area that I've really never seen the whole location put, certainly not on Sunday. It wouldn't have been a putt that he would have been able to practice, unlike the putt at 10, or would have practiced very often in his career. I've never seen the putt had or made except for that day. And it'd been very easy for him to knock it, you know, 10 feet, 15 feet past the hole. And it was that point in the round where if he had missed it, there had been a sense that the game was getting away from him. Anyway, he hit the most beautiful putt with drip speed and it fell in on its last roll. And I posted it just because it's, I think, the best putt I've ever seen by one of the best putters. And I said that, you know, nobody is a born putter or an inevitable one. It's achieved through hard work. And, you know, it caused a bit of an uproar. You know, people were like, no, it's a gift. You know, you're either born putter or you're not. And like, nothing could be further from the truth. People love to say it because they can't explain why some people are good at things and some people are not particularly good at things. And so it must be a gift, which makes them feel better, I guess, and also helps explain something that they otherwise couldn't explain. But almost, well, in every case, when you go look back at what you think is a prodigy or a savant or a gift, at least in everyone that I could find and everyone that anybody's managed to write about, it is, you know, it is, the mystery is solved by an inordinate amount of time at a very young age spent. And this certainly even goes back to Tiger Woods. But I was thinking along the lines of people like Picasso or Pascal or Mozart, who all had very attentive fathers who, when they were, you know, a year old, were impressing upon them the importance of musical notes or artistic skill or the ability to write and think. And with Tiger, it was to swing a golf club. So at a very young age, you know, by the time they were four or five, they've already put in an inordinate amount of time and a very attentive at a period of time when you are the most imitative and malleable. Mm-hmm. And so they certainly weren't born with it. If you take away Mozart's father, if you take away Picasso's father or Pascal's father, or you take away Earl Woods, you do not get Tiger Woods. You do not get Mozart. You do not get Picasso. You do not get Pascal. You do not get these so-called innate golfers that people love to claim in Crenshaw. You take away Harvey Penick, you're not going to get Ben Crenshaw. Ben Crenshaw's putting stroke. If you take away the influence of Michael Bannon or Rory's father, you're likely not going to get Rory. It comes about in a very
I think, obvious way, really. And it's thousands of hours, but it's not just the hours. It's not the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours. It's not about that. It is about certainly thousands of hours, but thousands of hours where you build visual representations of what it is you want to do and how you want to do it. But it is deliberate practice of the correct principles. So when people say, I'll just go out and work harder and I'll get there. And it's like, no, that doesn't work. You have to go out and work harder at the correct things at a very young age when you are the most imitative, when you are the most malleable. And then you create visual representations that you carry with you for the rest of your life. I think Charlie Reimer chimed in and said, Jack Nicklaus told me he didn't practice his putting much because it hurt his back, and he was a great putter. So that disproves your claim. I say, well, with all due respect, I'm sure if we went back and looked at Jack Nicklaus's development as a golfer, he would have spent thousands upon thousands of hours practicing his putting stroke, developing it, and at a very young age, stumbled onto, let's say, the right things to do, or divined them out of the best putters of all time. He would have created great visual representations of the correct stroke, and then he would have enjoyed the fruits of that hard work and those visual representations for the rest of his life. It's a matter of deliberate practice doing the correct things. And I think that the South Koreans, one of the reasons why they're putting out so many, a disproportionate number given their population, they're 1/5 of the United States population, and they're producing, I don't know, 3 times the number of golfers in the top 50 in the world. And I think they're doing it exactly the same way Tiger Woods learned to play the game. You go back and watch it. You can find that video of Tiger Woods on Fran Tarkenton's lap where that show, that's incredible. Tiger Woods is 5 years old. They do this 5-minute piece on Tiger. I'm sure you've seen it. Mm-hmm. At about, I think it's a little more than 2 minutes into that video, you see Tiger Woods sitting in a chair in the garage watching Earl hit golf balls. He's 5 years old at that point. Now, Earl tells a story shortly after that about an 11-month-old Tiger after Earl takes a break, gets up, hits a golf shot right into the net. So presumably Tiger Woods had been sitting in that chair watching his father hit golf balls for 5 years. Now, you don't think that creates a powerful visual representation of the proper golf swing? So in South Korea, that is exactly how they're learning to play the game mm-hmm. at a young age. They're in an environment where they're not doing things that are outcome biased, not about shots, not about scores. It's about the proper mechanics, deliberate practice of the correct principles. So they're developing the moves necessary at a very young age when, again, they're the most imitative and malleable. They have those moves, and then they go out on a golf course, and with those moves, they're now able to create every aspect of the game. And because they're not thinking about golf swing when they're playing the game, because they've created and done the work as kids, they go out and learn to play the game. They learn all the shots, they learn about strategy, and then they can get to and unravel the higher aspects of the game, which are about finding a calmness when you play the game. That calmness that Tiger was able to develop at a very young age. And then they enjoy those gifts throughout their careers. So this is why, at least in my view, South Koreans are putting out a disproportionate number of great players. We're not training the same way here in the United States. You know, our kids want to get out on the golf course as fast as possible. They want to start shooting scores as fast as possible. And this does them a disservice. I think we could all learn a lot from the way Tiger Woods learned to play the game, the way the South Koreans are training their young players. And I think there's much to learn in that regard. And we're missing out because of it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Jack. And everybody talks about Jack Nicklaus later in his career not really being a ball beater and only playing because he loved competition. But he's also said, maybe not as publicly, that he doesn't think anybody hit as many balls during his time, era, you know, late 50s, from the age of, let's say, 11 to 14, in every aspect, except for chipping and putting. Well, not putting. He was a good putter, but he didn't chip much, and it cost him later in life. But he definitely developed all these deliberate practice habits And maybe that's the most accountable thing as far as why he was so great. I wonder, though, you know, I was listening to a podcast the other day, Fresh Air, you know, on NPR with Terry Gross, and she was actually it was Dave Davies interviewing Hank Azaria, who's a great mimic. He does like 30 voices on The Simpsons. And, you know, so how did this happen? You know, how did you become a mimic? And he goes, you know, it's like people, the way Hank Azaria described, it's like people who can curl their tongue underneath. It's just a given kind of knack that I was born with that I can do. And yes, once I liked the feeling of it and the result of it and getting laughs and realizing I was good at it, I practiced more, but it started with a particular gift. And I just wonder, you know, you were a great athlete. You rode horses as a kid, you know, you adapted to things that were physical quite easily. And I just wonder how much that's just a constant in any great athlete. Not that they don't work at it once they got it, but it must start with something in terms of knowing that you have the proprioception and the hand-eye coordination that allows certain things that then encourage you to develop it further. Or do you feel like, hey, there is no real starting point if you work hard enough and you want it enough and you have the examples in front of you and the model of deliberative practice? I think it's an interesting sort of debate. I would sort of still go towards that sort of original gift as the starting point. And from there, the work, you know, makes the difference.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of gifts, again, I think it's, I think it's a myth. I don't believe in it at all. Just to go back to Mozart very quickly, one of the most amazing things about Mozart, besides his ability to play almost any instrument at a very young age beautifully, was his ability to identify any note, the difference of any note, whether it was played from a trombone or you sneezed, he could tell you what note it was. He was then, you know, it was called perfect pitch or pitch perfect, whatever you want to call it. And it was so incredibly rare and for so long believed to be a gift. In fact, only 1 in 10,000 people has perfect pitch. That's how rare it was. You know, Frank Sinatra had it, Miles Davis didn't, on and on and on through the music industry. And it was believed to be a gift until in the 90s, a man in Japan decided to test this idea, this belief that it was just a gift. You either had it or you didn't. 1 in 10,000 people has it. If you're not that, you don't have it. Sorry, you didn't get it. You weren't there when God passed it out. So he took 24 kids, and over a year to a year and a half, he took each one of these kids, put them in a room, and it was 2-3 hours a day. He tested them and exposed them and back and forth over every single note from every single instrument and built up. And at the end of a year and a half, how many of those 24 kids had pitch perfect or perfect pitch? All 24. 24 out of 24. Absolutely all of them. So what were they doing in that year and a half? They were practicing deliberately long hours of the correct principles of sound. So it turned out not to be a gift at all. And you go back and you look again at Mozart's adolescence or even, you know, his childhood, his infancy. And his father did exactly those things that the Japanese man did in his study. Not a gift at all. It was just at a very young age, they were exposed to the right sounds and deliberately practiced the correct principles. Yes, I was a good athlete, but I worked harder than anybody else. You know, when I took up golf, and I took up golf, and 2 years later, I was a very good player. It was like, you have a gift. I was like, no. I mean, it was nice to hear people say it because it sounds great, doesn't it? That you were just giving something. I mean, who doesn't like gifts? But looking back, I'm like, no. I didn't have a gift. I hit balls. You know, my dad told me once, he said, I'll take you to the golf course no matter what hour you wake me up. And I can remember waking him up at 4:30 in the morning. He gets out of bed and he was like, well, when you said, you know, when I said I'd take you at any hour, I certainly didn't think it was the middle of the night. And I was like, yeah, but this, you know, the sun's going to come up at 5:30. I'm going to get right there at 5:30. He was like, when do you want me to pick you up? I was like, when the sun goes down at 9:30. So, you know, I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of time to be at a golf course. I ate a cheeseburger and had a Dr. Pepper and a water fries somewhere in there. But mostly I just played golf and putted people and practiced. And then when I'd come home,
I had divots in the carpet and holes in the wall where I would swing to. And then my dad would repair the carpet, repair the walls, and tell me not to do it, wink, wink. And, you know, I tore up the front yard and the backyard and broke windows and cars 200 yards down the street from my house. My dad told me not to do it, wink, wink. And I went to the church down the street and thinned one, and it broke the stained glass window of the church during Sunday services. And they all came out looking at me like, you know, I was evil. And I was standing there with a, no, it was hard work. You know, my dad had to pay for the dang window at church. Wink, wink, don't do that again. You know, but all the while I knew he was loving the fact that I was passionate about something. So if I would have been playing chess, I would have been really good at it. It didn't matter. It's just the hours, the attentiveness, the hard work. Was I a good athlete? Sure, because I worked at it. So, you know, I think anybody similarly inclined in any endeavor, if they're willing to do the right work the right way, they're going to get good at it. Now, of course, it matters when you stumble onto these things. You know, as an athlete, you know, if you're going to be a great musician or great at chess or great at golf, it matters that you do it early because you're developing skills, and it's important that you develop them at a young enough age where you're the most imitative and the most malleable. And then you can enjoy them for the rest of your life and further develop more nuanced aspects of that game. But I'm not a believer in gifts, at least. Sure, does it explain a small portion of people's success? Okay, I'll grant that. But not in the way that people use it, myself included, at least early on in my commentary. It's the only way that you can explain what Shakespeare did. You know, if you give somebody the exact same experiences, do they write Hamlet? Probably not. But there's so much that we do not know about Shakespeare. You know, how is it that he could use every single great book ever written seemingly as a source book? He knew them that fluently. We don't know as much as we need to know about Shakespeare's education to arrive at any reasonable guess about how he became the genius that he became. So we just say he must have had just gifts. But when you know enough and you look close enough, those gifts become less of a gift and more a product of hard work and being in the right place at the right time so that they had access to the right information.
Well, the fact that you lived this gives it a lot of credibility, and you've given hope to everybody who wants to be great at something. There's a path. There's a model. It's not necessarily you're trapped by your genetics or other things, according to your experience and according to all your research. So that's given me a different perspective too, just listening to that. By the way, let's move on quickly to the Masters as a possible, you know, event this year.
Yeah,
certainly it's missed, not happening in April. I wonder what you think of the ramifications if it is played or if it isn't played, if it should be played, if it is played, how it would look and feel compared to April, what its importance might be relative to the golf world itself. I think it is something that could be really inspirational, but maybe the practicalities don't work. What are your thoughts?
Well, I hope it's played because that means that the surreal nature of this quarantine that we're all living through is abated, and we can poke our heads out and say, is everything okay? And get back to life to some extent. So I certainly hope it will eventually be played this year. And you look at, anything's on the table, isn't it? I mean, you know, there's obviously the scheduling conflicts that it's going to go up against another event. Should it be played anytime, you know, unless it's played in December, which is unlikely. But I've heard the October date kicked around, and the one is the 5th through the 12th. But that, you know, that's the same week as the Shriners. It's the same week as the Italian Open and the European Tour. So, you know, how are they going to work out those scheduling conflicts? But it seems to me there's nobody quicker or better at adapting to scenarios than the men and the women that run Augusta National. It's
you know, I think it's the most amazing, in a lot of aspects, the most amazing course and tournament anywhere in the world, how quickly they can turn things around and make things look beautiful and playable. You know, they have great control over the golf course in terms of, you know, the systems underneath the ground that allow them to control the moisture and the temperature of the grass and so forth. So they can create miracles there. So let's hope they play. And if they play, you know, after the end of the FedEx Cup, let's hope the FedEx Cup, you know, eventually, you know, plays out, that we get some golf in this year and give us all something to think about besides this dreadful coronavirus. But it's hard to imagine a year without, you know, the Masters, U.S. Open, the Open, PGA. It's like, you know, how are all these events going to unfold? This is a Ryder Cup year. It's an Olympic year. Like, how is it all, you know, some of these events are going to have to fall away. And it's disappointing, surely. But again, there are far greater things to be worried about than those. So if they're up and playing again, it says good things about the state that we're in.
Yes. You know, we did have lost years in sports during World War II. And
yes,
probably what's happening right now is as close to that as, you know, maybe we've had in the last 100 years.
Yeah, you're right.
World War I, of course, was equally disruptive. But this is so unique in terms of how it keeps people apart, just because of danger in proximity. Whereas before it was simply that everybody was at war, but we're all here, but we still can't do anything unless things change. And like you said, if it is played, it'll mean life has changed. I think any sort of particulars about the Masters not being exactly the Masters, if it is played, just pale in comparison to the big picture effect of getting golf back, you know, in some sort of, form that will have so much pent-up demand and enthusiasm that it'll really be maybe one of the greatest events in the history of the game, just in terms of, hey, we're back, and this is the place it should start, you know, the game where it begins, in terms of the, you know, the yearly ceremony of April, and what it'll be, you know, the beginning at the end. But in any event, I hope it is played, and let's have to wrap this up now. Been a pleasure again, and we'll talk to you again all soon. Thank you, Brandel.
Look forward to it, Jaime.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.